Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea. I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. Usually I just have one guest, but today I'm welcoming two guests. Kat McDavitt and Lisa Berry are co-hosts of the not-to-be-missed weekly health tech talk show. Kat is the president and founding partner of Incentum, and Lisa is the CEO of Civitas Networks for Health. They do a bunch of other stuff, but I'm not going to list that out right now. Suffice it to say, they know the ins and outs of healthcare, and they're troublemakers of the first degree. They could sniff out BS like a couple of hound dogs, so I'm a little scared to talk to them today, but I'm going to put on my big boy pants and talk to them. Kat and Lisa, welcome to Tate Chronicles.
Thanks for having us. That was an amazing intro.
Well, we're going to play a little game today. I have a list of topics. I'll introduce the topics, and then I just want you to respond as freely as you can off the top of your head, free associate any way you want to. And let me say to the audience at home, these topics were not shared in advance with the contestants. So hopefully we'll get some good comments. Won't have to vote anybody off the healthcare island, but we'll see. Okay, so first topic, interoperability. What the heck is going on with interoperability? What's this TEFCA business? What are the QNs? Does it even matter? What's it going to fix? What's the problem?
Oh my gosh. I mean, listen, first of all, you know, the idea that interoperability would be fixed by a data standard or an adoption or a new national network is just ahistoric, right? Just understanding how all of this has developed over the past 20, 30, 40 years, right? That's never happened in the history of time and never will. You need to get people together. You need to get them aligned. You need to align their incentives to make this kind of stuff work and make this transformation happen. And what we see right now is just this real focus on we have the one solution that will fix it, which I know Kat also is not a fan of.
Hey, you're not a fan of what's the one solution? Is this TEFCA or what?
Is it? We don't know. The focus right now is on TEFCA. So here's the deal. I think both Lisa and I are supportive of additional paths to exchange health data effectively. So we are supportive of the concept of TEFCA. Absolutely. Lisa, I might be putting words in your mouth, but I feel like I've heard them enough that it's fine. I think that the problem we both have with TEFCA is that we are going to need a lot of different paths to interoperability. Interoperability does not mean we all do one thing. That's not the freaking point. That's called, like, you know, Epic, right? That's Monopoly. That doesn't work. That's not what we're talking about here. And I think people often conflate those two things, which is hilarious because interoperability is like literally the opposite thing. And I was talking to one of our mutual friends, the great Paul Wilder of Commonwealth last night. And we were, you know, talking about interoperability as we do randomly on Tuesdays. And he brought up a really nice metaphor for this whole thing. And he's like, we need to be pursuing shovel ready projects. Like, we should not be saying, let's stop all of the shovel ready projects and like city plan. And I was like, that's really good, Paul. And he's like, oh yeah, I stole it from someone else. Who knows who that is, but I hope they get credit one day. But yeah, like there are a lot of other paths right now for health data exchange, like a lot. And Lisa represents all the HIEs and the health data organizations. Mm-hmm. I represent a whole lot of private sector companies. Yep. We're all exchanging data like pretty effectively. And I think that we're forgetting that that's happening and improving some of those existing rails for city planning. Which, you know, will happen sometime.
Decades or centuries, right? That city planning, centuries. You know, we don't have centuries. We don't have time to wait for that. Stuff is already happening. Just like Paul said or stole that phrase, we need more shovel-ready projects.
Yeah, we need shovel-ready projects. And, you know, also the bummer is here, you know, bringing people to the table, like Lisa said, we need more people on the right side of the table collaborating, like not yelling at each other from across the table. And unfortunately, I think the way that some of the TEFCA collaborative efforts have been executed has done what it's not supposed to do, which is scatter people, put them at odds, and they're not supportive. Okay. So it's a bummer, right? Because we risk failure. We risk like years of...
Part of it is saying the expectations. I read something last week. Somebody was talking about with TEFCA, we're going to cross the finish line.
Who said that? Absolutely not.
I'm not. Come on, man. I will send you that link privately.
Who is that guy?
I'm going to send it to you. Okay, we've chewed that bone enough. AI in healthcare. Where are we in the hype cycle? Can it get much higher?
We are in the very, we are really, if we're not at the top, we are very, very close. The hype cycle is out of control, completely separated from reality. You know, it's a little embarrassing after the blockchain debacle of, you know, the mid odds, right? You know, it's just, come on, guys. We've had a recent example of a meaningless hype cycle that doesn't actually go towards solving real problems in healthcare. And, you know, is AI a tool? Is advanced data predictive analytics a tool for somewhere? For sure. Of course. Yes. Of course. It is not a panacea. Gen AI in particular is not going to solve healthcare problems in the next 20, 30, 40 years. No way.
Agree. I think we're at the top, and I think we're starting to hear some of the negative chatter. Because I think at Vive, Lisa, like we heard a lot of people, I actually moderated an AI panel.
Oh, wow.
And the AI guy was like, yeah, AI in healthcare right now is really just fancy automation. Like that's what it is. And everybody's doing the big words and saying they're an AI company, but that's just not the case. And we also, was it, Lisa, who do we interview? Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, AMA?
The president of the AMA.
Yeah, what did he say? He was like, AI is not going to replace doctors, but doctors who leverage AI will replace doctors who don't. And I think like that, okay, like that's like meaningful and reasonable.
Data. Just say data. Doctors who leverage data and whose clinics, whose teams leverage data will do better over time than those who don't. It doesn't have, he can say AI because he has to, because everyone has to say that right now, but it's really about how you leverage and use data. And there are tools for analyzing data and for, you know, predicting things from data. And you can call it AI if you want to, whatever, I don't care.
Yeah, you know, the other crazy thing, like people have to be freaking careful. I was talking to this this startup yesterday and, you know, I was like kind of unprepared for this call. I didn't really know, I like forgot who we were talking to. And I was like, well, tell me about your product. And he goes, our product diagnosis. And I was like, whoa, we're not talking, like, I am not going to represent you. Your technology does not diagnose. Like, holy shit. So I was like freaking out because I was like, does this guy really think this is like a regulatory risk? Like, what the hell? Like, I think people don't know what the hell they're talking about. I think people don't get that AI can just mean automation. I don't know. Like, I think, like, you've heard us say this on our talk show. Like, it's just kind of dumb.
Okay. Before we go into the next one, let me, for those audience members who've arrived late. If you're just joining us, I'm Jim Tate. In this episode of the Tate Chronicles, I'm trying my best to control the antics of Kat and Lisa, co-hosts of the weekly health tech talk show. Okay. The Change Healthcare hack. That's a big deal. What do you think?
It's like a big freaking deal.
It's giant.
Y'all. And like, Lisa and I were talking about this like crazy. Like that's a huge deal. Like that is like, I mean, how much of our health data infrastructure runs on the Change Healthcare rails? It's like most of the EDI pipes in the country are Change Healthcare. And it's been down for what? 2 weeks, close to 2 weeks. And it's just making national news. Like you got like, what the hell? You gotta be freaking kidding me.
Go ahead, Lisa, I wanna hear.
I read the New York Times almost every day, and you know, it was yesterday, I think, that the first real thorough in-depth article came out. This is, early March here. I think it was March 5th that it came out, and a well-reported article from Reed Abelson and others. But that was a long time to really get people to care and know and understand the issue. And this happens so often with anything around like healthcare, regulation, infrastructure, technology. It's too complicated. It's too hard for people to understand. Right. They don't actually report on it well. And that's really concerning. This is a massive, massive part of our economy. So much is happening here. And really, the response from both United Healthcare Optum and from the federal government has been woefully, woefully lacking in terms of how are you going to help the physicians and practices and offices don't have money. Billing. They have a cash flow problem. Right. Billing is not happening. It's a huge deal.
One fifth of the economy is healthcare revenue cycle.
Most of the media stuff was about, well, if I go to the pharmacy, I have to pay full price for my ketamine.
Right.
Because they can't verify my insurance. But you've hardly heard anything about the providers not being able to bill or, you know, submit billing electronically. That's
well,
big.
Lisa has fully been doxing this issue. So she was bringing up, she found a bunch of stuff on that, you know, a bunch of calls to start a fund for physicians, right, Lisa? There's like all kinds of wild stuff going on there.
And the amount of money that Change has offered some of these practices as a short-term loan.
Just to be clear, it's a loan, Jim. It's a loan.
Right.
So, okay, there are real issues with getting a cash advance of some kind versus a loan, which requires all kinds of things.
Exactly.
And have serious negative consequences for a practice.
Right.
That's not okay, in my opinion.
Well, in these loans, anecdotally, a lot of people say, well, I've been offered a $4,000 loan.
Perfect.
From Change Healthcare. And
that's great.
And their payroll, you know, in a large practice is so much more of that. Right. It's a giant hack. It looks like there's a probability that $22 million was paid in ransom a couple of days ago. We believe it came from Change Healthcare. Evidence is it kind of did.
Seemed like a very low amount of money to me, Jim. I was surprised. I was kind of like, is that real? And then also I would say, you know, I don't know how much the U.S. government is assisting in this process. I assume quite a bit. But generally, their advice is to not pay these ransoms. So it's really interesting that they're, who knows if this is actually accurate, because they usually don't pay the ransom.
Right.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago when Colonial Pipeline got hacked.
Yep.
They paid $3.4 million. I didn't know it may be if the hackers thought that's all, they couldn't spend that in five lifetimes. I don't know where they're coming from for such a low ransom.
I don't know. I'll say this, though. The healthcare revenue cycle is one fifth of the U.S. economy. That's freaking insane. This is a big deal. I mean, not all of it is on Change rails, but like a lot of it is.
A lot.
And this is an attack. Like, this is not just like Change Healthcare screwed up, right? Like, this is a cyber attack. It's not good.
It's kind of like they screwed up, though, Kat. I mean, this is really my understanding of the issue is that, you know, in the situation when there's an acquisition of a big piece of technology or infrastructure, that's a really like easy target for hackers, because people who worked there before have maybe left or on their way out. The new company hasn't fully taken over the infrastructure. Yeah. It's secured the way they have. This is an area where you could say, hey, this might be a risk. We should put in place extra protections, extra guardrails to make sure that we're not at risk, because it's such an important part of the infrastructure. This goes back, though, as we talk about all the time, to monopolies in healthcare. Huge risk for security, huge risk for national security when you have this kind of situation. We talked to a couple folks we've talked to people who are either building new rails to try and diversify the infrastructure, and also those who are innovating on top of the existing rails. I hope, fingers crossed, we'll see more of that, because this is a big, huge risk.
Yeah. Not ideal. And unfortunately, it's like, you know, no one thinks about it, right? Just like you're saying, like the press doesn't even get it. Right. Like, no one gets it.
Well,
it's wild.
You know, I think the press kind of viewed it as, here's another hospital that's been hacked, not realizing
infrastructure.
That's running on these rails. Fascinating. Okay, let's move on to one of my favorite topics, I guess. The opioid crisis. Talk about. Go ahead. Say what you have to say about it. Start
like
off.
What do you like? We have like. Oh my God! I have so much to like. What do you? Where are we even starting? Holy shit!
I say to the cycle. I just.
Do you want to start? Let's just start with health data exchange, because that's where we've been at, right? Like, okay. So one of the things that really pisses me off about the opioid crisis, of many things, this is like one of my passion projects, as you probably know, since you've seeded this question, but is the fact that And it's getting better now. OCR just released revised guidelines for sensitive information, for exchanging and protecting sensitive information. But there is still so little of this behavioral health data exchanged. And obviously, like, I get why there are extra protections and there's stigma around people diagnosed with opioid use disorder. But that is also one of the reasons that clinicians, especially at like more emergent points of care, can't really help people who have OUD, right? Because this data, it's tricky, and even a lot of HIEs don't want to touch it, right? So it's we're starting to get more sophisticated players in this space who will exchange this data and understand how to protect it, but how to use it for care coordination effectively. And it is like one of the biggest problems we have. And I'm hoping there are going to be some innovators in multiple states that are going to leverage opioid settlement funding for better technology infrastructure in their states.
Yes.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Lisa? Yeah. So I'll let you talk.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, I think just like Kat said, the stigma is one of the biggest problems, not just in data exchange, but also the treatment. There is ample, overwhelming, incredibly solid evidence that medication-assisted treatment is incredibly important to prevent people from relapsing, preventing overdoses. It allows opioid use disorder and substance use disorder broadly to be treated and controlled and maintained. And it is incredibly important that you don't have, you know, a lot of stigma when courses of treatment are being considered. And of course, it has dramatically affected the OUD treatment landscape in terms of the number of doctors who can prescribe medications to this treatment, in terms of people's perception of, you know, stigma, should I take this forever? Or what does that mean? Hey, you know what? Better for you to stay alive and not relapse, not overdose. And, you know, imagine there should be some kind of, we should all be able to just tough it out. That is not realistic. The evidence is against that. And I think those things go hand in hand. Once we can get rid of the stigma around treatment, around the best treatment, we also can get rid of the stigma around data exchange and people having data registered, you know, about them and about their OUD or SUD treatment. So I just think we got to get over it.
Go ahead, Kat.
I'm sorry. I have like big feelings. You like shouldn't have asked this question because I have like so many feelings, but like, again, believer in incremental progress here. And I think we are making incremental progress in several markets, but just yesterday, Matthew Holt actually sent us, I think he sent it to you too, Lisa, the Stat News article, how the U.S. is sabotaging its best tools to prevent deaths in the opioid epidemic. Right.
And
it's about, the fact that like they, you know, technically access to methadone and buprenorphine have like increased, but in practice it's not, it's right. really difficult to access. Still, it's difficult to get physicians
not
to treat
prescribers.
You, not enough prescribers, even with the removal of X waiver, right? Like, and then on top of that, these people, they don't always live near MOUD clinics, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are very few options for like video, the VDOT solutions. And it's like, it's so frustrating because these people need so much support. This is like not like, this drug is so horrible and so terrible. And this isn't something where like, you know, you need to stop eating French fries, right? This is like rewiring your brain. And the fact that we can't wrap services around these people to support them is just like so horrible.
Okay. I like to follow the money. So
me too. Oh my God.
And so, you know, so obvious major pharmaceutical companies, of course, the poster child is Purdue Pharma, which made, I don't know how many billions of dollars selling opioids and promoting opioids and paying a $1 million bribe to practice fusion to have a clinical decision support rule that recommended without any evidence-based stuff. And, you know, I mean, if this isn't the crime of the century, and of course the amount of money that the pharmaceutical companies, that Walgreens, that CVS, all the distributors made tons of money. I interviewed yesterday a fellow from the Opioid Policy Institute, what he's done is, you know, if you Google, I want some opioid treatment or resources of information, most of those websites are collecting information on you.
Yes, they are.
Identifiable information. And so, you know, he tracks all those websites and the kind of data that they're collecting. But the other thing that you mentioned, Kat, was the settlement money. That website, Opioid Policy Institute, really has a lot of data and graphs on how different states, what they're doing with that settlement money. So, and it's ongoing. So we're going for that forever. Okay, we only got about six more minutes. I got to move on.
I feel like you should let Lisa comment on Practice Fusion, as she was a former employee of that company.
Please. And in the blog thing I wrote, I had a lot of good friends who worked there, and I feel they were besmirched.
Oh, 100%. So what I will say is, like, as much as I love to dunk on Practice Fusion, I don't think Practice Fusion was the only player who was involved in that, in things like, you know, unsolicited clinical decision support that pushed people towards prescribing opioids. It's just one that got caught because they were so sloppy.
By the Department of Justice,
Exactly. And, you know, relatively small impact in terms of number of physicians, but people were certainly affected, and I'm glad that they were caught, and I'm glad that it was stopped. But there's a much broader issue across the industry at that time. As you noted, there was overprescribing everywhere. It wasn't driven just by Practice Fusion. It was driven by the entire industry, by the education, by the pushing of people to prescribe, by the misrepresentation of pain. Well, so I would just say, you know, people got caught up in it, but generally, this was a broad industry-wide issue. Everybody was beholden to Purdue Pharma.
Listen, and it continues, because if people go online seeking some type of information or treatment, their data is being taken and it's being sold. I call it 100%. Exit to the gift shop. We're going to get you coming in and we're going to get you coming out. We're going to just keep doing it. Okay, enough of that. Yep. We got to move on. What's your biggest pet peeve in healthcare today? One, give me your biggest pet peeve.
Nobody wants to talk about who should earn less money. Nobody wants to have that conversation about
respect.
Well, it's not just me. Kat always says this as well. You know, we really believe that, you know, there's not an unending pool of money. We can't just keep printing money and increasing the cost of healthcare. Somebody has to earn less money, but who is it? Nobody wants to have the real conversation about that.
No one wants to do that. And you know, do we decrease the labor pool, right? To, like, what do we screw up pharma? It's such, like, a tricky question. Well, yeah, that already happened. That's a natural thing that's happening. But, and we actually stole that question from Dr. Darshak Sanghavi, who always seems to ask that at the most dramatic times. But my biggest pet peeve is, like, it's kind of the same, but a little bit higher level. Like, to Lisa's point, like, no one wants to talk about X. I think that we have a real problem in this industry. We're like, no one wants to talk about the fact that, like, everybody's talking about what a heap of trash XYZ thing is, right? And so there's people go along with policies and, like, don't confront things and just go along with the crowd. And then guess what? They don't work. And we could have had a more collaborative, better solution up front if everybody was just, like, willing to express their opinion.
And you know, we are like rodeo clowns. To take, you know, John Blair, the CEO of MedAllies, was an actual rodeo clown. We are basically rodeo clowns, right? And that's fine. Like, that's our role, is to kind of, like, say, like, hey, look here. But we're getting people to start being willing to talk about this kind of stuff in maybe a little bit more of an offensive way than others, because we are pretty irreverent in our approach.
Yes, you are.
We're just being honest.
We don't necessarily have bosses. Ourselves.
Yeah, we're a little bit out in the wild here. We're our own bosses right now, more or less. I do have a board. Thank you very much, board of directors. But at the same time,
but Lisa, if they fire you, just come over. It's no problem. We've already talked about this.
So we take our revenue approach to try and maybe spark some of these conversations. It seems to be working to some extent. People are taking notice that we are less afraid of talking about what's actually happening in the industry.
My biggest pet peeve right now is the move by public corporations into purchasing community-owned hospitals.
Yeah.
That is a load of bullshit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that is. Horrendous. I'll just leave it at that. Okay, so let me move on to another one. When I listen to y'all's shows, you're always saying, oh, we heard this rumor, we heard that rumor. Give me some recent rumors. We got about a minute and a half. Give me some recent rumors. What the hell's going on out there? What's the next shoe to drop?
So many.
That's a hard one.
Well, I mean, I think that unsurprisingly, you know, getting people to sign on to V.5 of TEFCA has been very difficult. That's somewhat of a rumor.
Yes.
You know, there's been a lot of delays and issues. I think that's been very, that's been relatively public, but that's definitely something we were hearing. It's like, why now? Why should I do this now? What's my motivating factor? So the selling points are difficult. Again, we've heard that a lot.
Sure.
What else? What's a good rumor, Kat? What else?
I mean, like, you know, back to the AI trend, I know there's been a lot of discussion about like multiple. So, I mean, this isn't a rumor, this is like kind of true. I mean, sometimes our rumors are true, sometimes they're not. But the fact that like there's a lot of the agencies are kind of piecemealing AI policy, which is like not the best, right? Which is going to make it difficult for organizations to do stuff. But oh, Lisa, you had like a great call out about the new AI group collaborative. Do we want to talk about that?
That's a good one. AI. We are people who have been in media, been in PR, been in, you know, adjacent to the regulatory apparatus of this country. And we know very well what it means when a very large corporation signs on to a big amount of support to an industry coalition. It means they are trying to stop regulation.
Yes.
It means
regulatory capture.
It's regulatory capture.
Yeah.
And I really individually appreciate all the people who are part of the Coalition for Health AI. And I'm sure that they have the best interests in mind. But at the same time, when that industry group is funded by Microsoft, I think we all know where this is going to go. Mm. I think they'll do some good work, but it's also going to stop the progress of regulation and control over AI from the government's perspective.
That's great. We're almost totally out of time. Let me mention the website for, I don't know how y'all do a weekly show, you know.
We don't either, honestly.
Do you prepare or just jump on there and start yapping?
Have you watched the show?
Yeah.
We clearly don't prepare.
Okay.
Clearly.
It really works for our lifestyles in that we don't have a lot of time to prepare for this kind of stuff. We talk all the time. So it's kind of just a continuation of our daily video chat.
Gotcha. Okay. I recommend it. HealthTechTalkShow.com. HealthTechTalkShow.com. We got to run.
Right. Or on LinkedIn Live almost every Friday.
Friday.
1:30.
Like, most of the time.
4:30 Eastern. Most of the time.
To our audience, thanks for joining me in this episode of the Tate Chronicles. And of course, special salute to my guest today, Kat McDavitt and Lisa Berry. You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.